Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to science fiction author Cory Doctorow, a widely published writer. His output has varied across short stories, novels and graphic novels, including multiple New York Times bestsellers. As well as writing, he's a passionate copyright law and intellectual property activist. His latest novel is Attack Surface, a standalone book set in the world of his previous hits Little Brother and Homeland. Cory Doctorow, welcome to Monocle Reads.
So tell us more about the premise of Attack Surface.
Well, Attack Surface is the third novel in the Little Brother sequence. The first two, Little Brother and Homeland, were young adult books about a character, Marcus Yallo, starts off as a very young teen who is caught in what amounts to a police state when his hometown of San Francisco is bombed by terrorists and the Department of Homeland Security swoop in and effectively suspend the Constitution and all civil liberties. And he and his mates form a guerrilla army using things like hacked Xboxes that use cryptographically secured wireless networking to outmaneuver the DHS and eventually expel them from the city and restore human rights and civil liberties to the population. And the third book, Attack Surface, is a standalone novel for adults. And while the first two are about people who are terrified by the possibility of technology being used for oppression and excited about the possibility of technology being used for liberation, this third book's protagonist is the young woman Masha Maximo, who appears in the first two books as a kind of antagonist. In the first book, we meet her as a DHS contractor helping to spy on Marcus and his friends, even though she's of the same age and from the same background as them. In the second book, she's a beltway bandit working to spy on jihadis and disrupt insurgent networks in Iraq for the U.S. government at an enormous markup. And when we meet her in the third book, she's just gone full cyber mercenary, and her job is helping a thinly veiled version of a company like the NSO Group to spy on pro-democracy movements on behalf of post-Soviet dictators so they can figure out who to round up and torture and murder. And she has a reckoning with her conscience. She, on the one hand, has been spending her whole career finding ways to justify what she does, sneaking secrets out to Marcus and his friends so they could blow the whistle on wrongdoing, or helping Marcus escape from the DHS in the first book. But by the third book, she's really had to devolve into some pretty self-destructive conduct, like helping the people that she spies on defeat the tools that she herself is installing. And that's obviously not sustainable. And eventually she gets fired and worse and has to run away from this post-Soviet republic and finds herself back in San Francisco, where she discovers to her horror that her childhood best friend, who's now an organizer and a successor movement to Black Lives Matter, is being targeted by the very same cyber weapons that she herself has spent her whole life building. And while the first two books inspired a really large cohort of technologists and civil rights lawyers and human rights lawyers and activists and security researchers and cryptographers who wanted to use their technical and legal powers for good and to stave off technological apocalypse and dystopia, this third book is aimed more at the people who rationalize their way one decision at a time in tech and in other industries into participating in a vast confiscation of human liberty and human thriving in service to large corporations and oppressive governments, and to talk about what it means to pull back from the brink when you recognize one day that you can no longer justify what you've been doing.
And of course, Cory, that is exactly the situation we find ourselves in.
Absolutely. I mean, in 2018, we saw 20,000 Googlers walk off the job. Tech Won't Build It and Tech Solidarity and No Tech for ICE and other movements within the giant tech companies are not only organizing around technological issues, but also around labor and environmental issues. And you see technologists now reaching outside of their bubble. So for example, at Amazon, the movement for justice there within the company spans warehouse workers who are laboring under absolutely ghastly and what should be unlawful conditions, and tech workers whose initial concern was surveillance and climate, but who discovered that they could not make progress, nor could they feel good about their movement unless it incorporated the labor concerns of these people at the bottom of the ladder at the company.
Now, you are a special consultant to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that, because it would seem to me that the subject of your book and the work that you do there are very much interconnected.
Well, yes, indeed. And, you know, EFF is kind of the granddaddy of the digital rights movement, along with the Free Software Foundation and Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. We were really among the first on the scene to talk about how technology needed to be, on the one hand, optimized for human thriving, but on the other hand, needed to not be perverted for human oppression. And there's a story about EFF and organizations like it, that it was a kind of naive moment in which technologists could not understand that technology could be turned to harmful ends, and really just devoted themselves to blindly spreading it around the world in that kind of Zuckerbergian fashion of, you know, once everyone is connected, all the problems will be solved. And I don't think you start a movement like EFF because you're sanguine about the future of technology. I think you have to, on the one hand, be very excited about what could come, but also just scared as hell about how bad it can go, and animated by those two concerns. The work I do at EFF primarily is these days about competition, because tech, like every other industry, has become incredibly concentrated. And although there are people who say, oh, well, tech became concentrated because of something innate to technology, a network effect or a first mover advantage, what we see is that tech is concentrated for the same reason all the other industries are concentrated, whether that's accounting or logistics or finance or beer or professional wrestling or eyewear. It's concentrated because our regulators stopped enforcing anti-monopoly laws and allowed firms to engage in predatory conduct, like buying their nascent competitors before they could grow up to be threats, like Facebook did with Instagram, or merging with major competitors the way in the US Sprint and T-Mobile have, or creating vertical monopolies where they own a whole stack of technologies that allow them to squeeze suppliers and customers. And so, you know, you see that with Google and all of its acquisitions, or Apple and all of its acquisitions. And that turns the possibility of technology as a force for liberation into just yet another banal extractive industry that takes people who got into the industry because they were excited by the thrill of power that you get from writing code and being able to share it and improve other people's lives by making stuff that fixes your problems and then can fix other people's problems, and just turns them into the most banal agents of confiscation, into kind of petty prison guards who build walled gardens that just hold whole communities hostage.
Is it too late to break up those big four in particular?
I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, for one thing, we know that those businesses can run as standalones. You know, no one came down off a mountain with two stone tablets and said, you know, hearken unto my word, Larry and Sergey, from now on, thou shalt stop rotating thine log files and instead mine them for actionable market intelligence, right? That you can absolutely run a search engine that doesn't spy on you, in the same way that you can run a social network that doesn't spy on you. We had lots of those before Facebook came along. The difference between Facebook and its less surveillant predecessors is really the forbearance of regulators, not the wickedness of the founders, because I don't think Facebook was founded by particularly evil supervillains. I think that it was founded by banal sociopaths in the way that many firms are. But instead, it found itself in an environment where no one punished it for doing bad things, and it could just mount one sin atop another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's zone in on some of these problems. First of all, surveillance technology. I mean, obviously, we know that this is growing apace daily. How dangerous is it? Should we care that we're being watched?
Well, I think that there's a version of why we need to worry about surveillance that I'm not very sympathetic to, but then there's another story about it that I'm very, very sympathetic to and worried about. And the version that I'm not all that concerned about is the story that goes that Facebook and Google created a mind control ray to perfect the sale of fidget spinners, and then Robert Mercer and Cambridge Analytica stole it and made your uncle a racist. And I just don't think that that's what happened. I think that what ad tech does, and what technology does more generally, network technology does more generally, is locate people based on traits. And so if you want to sell a refrigerator, the best way to sell that refrigerator is to find people who have looked at refrigerator reviews, who have looked up repair for their existing refrigerator, who have entered into a contract with a kitchen remodeler, and then you can capture someone who wants to sell a refrigerator, or buy a refrigerator rather. And buying a refrigerator is an incredibly rare event, right? The median person buys one or fewer in their whole life. And so, you know, this solves this problem. It also solves the problem of finding people who feel a way that you feel, that you've never been able to talk about, and that you don't even have the words for. Like, for example, if you feel like the gender you were assigned at birth is not your gender, you may not have even encountered the idea walking around in your skin, but you can type a few words into a search engine and locate a community and find that community and join it. It also allows people who feel ideas that they can't express aloud because they're subject to social sanction, because the ideas are terrible, to locate one another. So if you've got a burning desire in your breast to go to Charlottesville, dress up like a Civil War soldier and carry a tiki torch and chant "Jews will not replace us," that's not the kind of thing you can just sort of announce casually to your friends in case any of them feel the same way. But in the same way that, you know, Tinder lets you swipe right and then not have to face any kind of awkwardness unless the other person also swipes and then you both get a match, you can find the people who match your view without having to announce yourself to the people around you. And you can wait until you have a match before you disclose the true meaning of your views to them. And I think that that's a much truer account of what technology, including the surveillance part of technology, does for us. And it's a mixed bag, but I'm not prepared to jettison the idea that people who have heterodox views shouldn't be able to find each other. On the other hand, the part of surveillance that I worry about a lot is that it allows for hegemonic ideas, for the ideas that govern us, to perpetuate themselves by spying on people to discover their dissent and punish it before they can make any inroads. So whether that's, we've seen the rise now of something called bossware, which is technology that employers are insisting that their remote workers use. So it's not enough that you live at work. You know, it's what we call it work from home, but it's not really true. We live at work. We essentially rent our homes for free to our employers. And then they insist that we install in our laptops spyware that lets them covertly operate their cameras, microphones, track your eye movements, look at your web browsing habits, and so on. And that's, you know, among other things, a great way to head off trade union organizing or potential complaints about workplace safety or harassment, and to punish people before they even know that there are other people who feel the same way within the firm. And you know, last year during the wave of teacher strikes in the US, you had the companies that sell spyware to spy on school children to make sure they're not looking at boobies send out a pitch to school district administrators saying, you know, the teachers also have this software. If you want, we'll tell you which ones are union organizers so that you can fire them, right? So that's one of the reasons we should worry about surveillance, is it allows power to perpetuate itself. Mm-hmm. Another reason we should worry about surveillance is that the way that we move from a world in which things that are now considered commonplace and right were a felony within living memory is by allowing people who had these commonplace traits to themselves, that they believed in interracial marriage, or that they believed in marriage equality, or that they were queer, or that they wanted to smoke cannabis. Those people were able to disclose their true nature to the people around them in time and manner of their choosing, such that they could build coalitions and come forward. And unless you think that, like, today in 2020, we've attained the pinnacle of human social progress, and that, you know, in 50 years, your grandkids will say, how was it in 2020? We just stopped changing our social mores because we'd reached their apex. Then you should understand that there are people that you love whose happiness matters to you more than anything, who have never been their authentic selves with you. And if we don't give them the space to have a private conversation, they never will. And they will go to their grave in sorrow that you are the origin of, because they could never disclose who they were to you without risking that sanction. And so for that reason, we need to worry about surveillance as well. I don't think that the story of mind control is credible. I do think that you can locate people who already have a proclivity for bad ideas, right? People who've been scarred by corruption, and say to them, look, that relative of yours who died of an opioid overdose because regulators decided to let the Sacklers make billions of dollars flogging OxyContin, that relative of yours is the reason you shouldn't trust the vaccine industry. Because if the regulators and the pharmaceutical companies were willing to sit by idly while that happened, or even actively engage and profit from it, why should you believe them when they tell you vaccines are safe? And I think that that does put bad ideas into people's heads. But I think that emphasizing not being able to locate traumatized people instead of heading off the trauma that arises from corruption is a misplaced way of addressing what is a real crisis in our society.
I'd like to ask a really specific question here about Alexa, in that most people have one in their home, and people have complained to me that they mention something within the possible hearing of Alexa, and next thing they're being advertised that on their computer. Is that just a conspiracy theory?
So I don't think most people have an Alexa in their home. I think many people do, but that's certainly, thankfully, we have not reached the point where most people have an Alexa in their home yet. There are instances in which Alexa does covertly listen to you, mostly when it mistakes the wake word for something else. And in some important sense, Alexa never stops listening to you. The only way that Alexa can hear the wake word is if it's listening all the time. And we know that a lot of the speech that Alexa intercepts, including speech that was accidentally triggered, gets sent off to third parties. Amazon has admitted this, and those third parties are outside contractors who are working on improving speech recognition, but who also sometimes leak that information or you lose control of it, right? Get hacked and lose control of it. And I would not put an Alexa in my house if you put a gun to my head. Now, that said, I don't think that the way that you see an ad for something after you mention it aloud within Alexa's hearing, if Alexa's not listening to you, if you haven't explicitly told Alexa to listen to you, and if Alexa hasn't been accidentally triggered by a wake word, I think the reason you see the ad for that thing is because whatever it was that caused you to start talking about that thing, like an article that you read or some other stimulus in your environment, is something that was observed by these great surveillance ad tech networks. And so, you know, your discussion of it and the ad that you saw for it are both caused by whatever it was that triggered your interest in it.
Corey, I want to pivot now to mental health, particularly amongst teenagers, and ask if you think that our constantly on society, our digitally connected society, is having a negative impact on particularly teen mental health.
I think the answer is some of both, right? You know, one of the things that is extremely traumatic for teens, especially during lockdown, but even before lockdown, is to be in a bad home environment, to have a bad school environment. And one of the things that digital technologies do is they give those teens a way to escape that environment and to network with and be in solidarity with other people who are similarly situated, whether it's because they're trans or because they have abusive parents or parents who are, you know, fanatically religious or in some other way contributing to a bad home life. Those very unhappy teens spend a lot of time online to escape it. And unless we understand the causal relationship, it's very easy to say, oh, look at how unhappy all the teens who spend a lot of time online are. It must be that their online time is what makes them unhappy, as opposed to the idea that their online time is what keeps them from being suicidal, right? It's what gets them through the day in an otherwise unhappy life. Now, obviously, there are lots of pathologies that arise out of the digital environment, but they tend to reflect the pathologies of the real world environment. And even where you see unhappiness arising from networks, I think that we should understand the large extent to which that unhappiness stems from real world phenomena and is reflected in our digital world.
Yeah. Finally, Corey, your book has done extremely well. Attack Surface has done extremely well. And now, many of the ideas you've been talking about during this conversation are reflected within that book. And it's a book that goes right to the heart of Silicon Valley. Do you think that it may have an impact on the behavior of people there? Do you think people are ready to listen to these ideas?
Well, clearly something is changing in the culture of Silicon Valley. The mass walkouts, the changing economic circumstances of people from all walks of life, and the increasing sense that both the climate emergency and the inequality emergency can't be grappled with using the technology and the systems of today, I think is alarming people from every trade and in every profession and every sector. And technologists, you know, I think that there has been a historic temptation to engage in self-serving rationale in the manner that Upton Sinclair once articulated that it's impossible to explain something to someone whose paycheck depends on them not understanding it. And back when there was a, you know, credible story that you could tell yourself that if you forgave your boss's sins, you might be able to someday quit your job and become a billionaire yourself. And that story has been just vaporized, you know, first by the monopolization of tech and then by the pandemic. And I think that what we saw was that in the run-up to the pandemic, the median techie had given up on dreams of riches and self-determination and substituted for them a very comfortable retirement, free massages at the office on Wednesday, and a mini kitchen with kombucha on tap. And now they don't get the massages in the mini kitchen. And it's, you know, looking much more likely now that there's a global labor market that can be accessed from anywhere in the world, because once you go to a primarily remote work environment, then you don't have to confine yourself to hiring people who can get US work visas or who are already entitled to live in Silicon Valley. You can just hire anyone you want. And those people, I think, are becoming disillusioned. They're realizing that their allegiance lies mostly with the people that they've been hired to lock down and control through technology, and not with the people who hired them to do that.
Corey, absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for this.
Oh, likewise. It was a real pleasure to speak to you again. I hope we get to talk to each other in person again someday.
Corey Doctorow, thank you very much indeed. Attack Surface is published by Head of Zeus. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmercourt. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.